Welcome to practice period. For another 2 months, we have this time of Dharma activity. A couple sesshins, a couple classes, daily zazen, meetings of all types, tea, Dharma talks. We also start a year of warming the hearth, this year-long practice commitment. Just a couple people joined this round. Peter Sidlowski is one who often practices at Jikoji as well as here. And Ken Collins, who lives at San Francisco Zen Center. So this is a thing that can be done from out of town via Skype. Monthly meeting and study program. Also, we have a new experiment of having Tenzo for 1 year. Tenzo is the head cook of a Zen temple, and Reverend Myoka Kathy Toli is going to be Tenzo for a year. Maybe we could say starting right now. She's already started. I saw her taking everything off kitchen cabinets and dusting out all the cobwebs and cleaning them, and she's going to cook for this sesshin. And then you'll hear more about this as time goes on, but she's going to offer Tenzo classes, or kind of like learning to be Tenzo, so other people can learn cooking Zen, the Zen practice of cooking, and a class on Dogen's instructions to the cook, which includes the three minds of grandmotherly mind, kind, sometimes we call kind mind, and joyful mind, and great vast mind, and that is in accord with this year's theme, our kind of practice theme for 2014 is kindness, compassion, and the aspiration to realize awakening for the benefit of all beings. So many teachings and practices to support this theme we can explore together for the rest of our lives, but particularly for this year. Starting tomorrow, we have sesshin, a 5-day retreat on one of Dogen's writings on bodhicitta, the aspiration, the altruistic aspiration to awaken for all beings. Also, to begin the year, a new Dharma year, I made some of these, you may recall last year, Ofuda, they're called. It's like a blessing charm. And you can take one as you leave. If you like, they're on the donation box in the back there. Some people put them on their fridge. It's a tradition in Japanese Zen temples to make these at the beginning of the new year. It says Maha Prajna Paramita. So it's blessings of perfect wisdom. And a picture of our temple Dharma protector, Ida Somten, who guards the entryway out here. So you might not notice it when you pass by him there, but he removes all your dualistic thought as you walk by. It also says, lasting peace in the Sangha, tranquility in daily practice, disillusion of all misfortune and fulfillment of all relations, which is one of our dedications. Also, this is the first time speaking to you all since returning from this trip afar. I went to India and Nepal with a group of, there were 19 of us from around the country. Here I see Yarrow Jane is one in the room who is along with us, and on pilgrimage, and Shoho and I kind of co-led this pilgrimage around Kathmandu, where there's many amazing stupas and mountains and caves and practice places and teachers we met with, and it's kind of like her home these couple of years. So that's like she showed us around her neighborhood, and then we went down to the places of Buddha's life. We had a bus for our group with a wonderful driver and a wonderful assistant who would negotiate the chaos and beauty of this country we call India for us. Very helpful to have Indian locals helping us. And but we had this bus at our disposal. Very nice way to travel with this group. Sometimes we drove 5 miles an hour over very rutted dirt roads for hours and hours. We went to Lumbini, where Buddha was born, and which is kind of an archaeological site too. I think in the news in this last year, they discovered some deeper layer of excavation where they maybe even have new dates for Buddha's birth because of this. And then we went south to Kushinagara, where Buddha entered Parinirvana, which we celebrate this Sesshin. Quiet, small, dusty town. And then on to Bodh Gaya. Sarnath, the deer park at Isipatana near Varanasi, which is currently called Sarnath. Where Buddha set in motion the wheel of Dharma, and then to Varanasi itself, which is not a Buddhist pilgrimage site per se, but a very holy city on the banks of the Ganges, where cremation fires are burning night and day, and life and death is very upfront in that city. And then on to Bodh Gaya, where Buddha was awakened under the Bodhi tree. And there we stopped for about 5 days. We were moving along until that point. It was just a couple days at each place. Bodh Gaya, we could stay and enjoy that wonderful kind of magic of the Mahabodhi temple and the Bodhi tree. And with some day trips to Rajagir, Vulture Peak, where the Buddha taught the Heart Sutra and the Lotus Sutra, and Nalanda University, where many great ancestors taught. And I think that's pretty much it as far as the places. Because we were all Zen practitioners, we had the great joy of practicing Zazen together and sharing our Zen family style of chanting, which is mostly what everyone's doing at these places in many, many different languages, people coming from many different countries, but very rarely in English. So that was our offering, is powerful English chanting with a large group of Zen people. And we chanted sutras from that Buddha taught at those different places, and the verse of homage to the Buddha's relics and Buddha's mantra, and we made extensive offerings of flowers and incense and light and all kinds of things.
Golden robes.
We dressed the giant reclining Buddha in Kushinagara with a giant robe, and so on. What else from that trip, Yaro? What would you say to summarize?
Oh, to summarize, my goodness.
Or an anecdote, or
anything? I love going out to Sujata's village, Sujata being the one that when the Buddha austerities, kind of pre-enlightenment, thinking that that was the way. And, you know, his emaciated body almost died, and Sujata was the one who brought him some food, kind of once he figured out that this extreme of asceticism was not the way. So we went to Sujata's village, which was actually quite lovely. You know, pretty traditional village with all kinds of vegetables growing there, cauliflower and potatoes, and we walked out through the rice paddies. Actually, I guess they mostly grow wheat there, but they do it in the same way. They kind of submerge it the way they do the rice paddies. So there's walls around it. So we walked on the kind of the dikes between the paddies and then out to a temple. So I enjoyed that. It was kind of, it made it very personal. Like, oh wow, this actual person, Sujata, this is supposedly her village.
Sujata, who sometimes, you know, probably many people have never even heard of Sujata, but I have the feeling of she was a great bodhisattva because she made these offerings to basically save the Buddha from starvation and help the Buddha on the eve of his enlightenment. So that was, as you say, that was a wonderful place because maybe the most traditional village. It was because it was... Yeah.
By, you know, some of the westernization and modernization.
Like stepping into 500 BC, probably doesn't look much different.
Yeah.
The dwellings are made of mud and grass.
Yeah, and they've got the patties of dung drying on the walls. That's what they use for fuel. Goats and cows there. And then close by, a little temple to... the man who offered the Kushinagara grass, or the Kusha grass, so that, and that's in our sutra, so that he could make a zafu to sit on, a soft place to sit on.
Yep, on the banks of the Naranjana River, and also the cave where the Buddha practiced these austerities up on the hilltop. These were all places like little side trips from Bodh Gaya, on Bodh Gaya, near the Bodhi tree. Yeah, so a wonderful, wonderful event, I think. Just traveling in India is itself an amazing practice and way to let go of a lot of ideas about how things are. I noticed in particular this time, I was actually over there for a month and a half, so coming back to Santa Cruz was this kind of that reverse culture shock, you know? Like, this California is like so strange. American culture is so strange. And just almost surreal back once you get used to this completely different way of being over there. And the context was all around paying homage to Shakyamuni Buddha and meeting the Buddha and these places where he lived so long ago that are sometimes not so changed from the ancient times, and joining in these practices with pilgrims from all over the world. And so I think it offered a great opportunity for both the expression of devotion in a really, that we could practice and we could be inspired by these devotional expressions at these places, and also compassion. There's so much suffering, so much poverty. I really felt different coming back and seeing the homeless people in Santa Cruz. It's almost like it's like upscale homeless. I mean, people have a hard time, but this is like, you know, people really don't have enough food to eat and have no place to go in large numbers. And so that mix of like, you know, the sacred peace of these places and the extreme poverty. Sometimes the poorest people didn't seem so bad off. I think it's maybe a thing in our culture too. There's more sort of like, you know, blame it on somebody. for the most down and out, there, maybe it's because of the teachings of karma, like pervading that culture, but a deep feeling of acceptance in the midst of very simple living. So this combination of devotion and compassion, being kind of like devotion and compassion were constantly being pushed our way, almost unavoidably opened to these emotions. And I thought, how wonderful for this year of looking at kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta. I think for this aspiration of bodhicitta to arise, some of the conditions for it are kindness, compassion, and devotion. Devotional expression to the Buddha, both Shakyamuni Buddha and all Buddhas, and the Buddha nature that pervades all beings. But there's all kinds of physical ways we can express that, right? Like we making offerings and bowing and chanting and zazen, and this making this connection with Buddha through devotion like this is this reminder of the Buddha's great compassion, and Buddha's bodhicitta kind of encourages our bodhicitta. I feel this way. There's some stories, some ancient stories about how did the Buddha become a Buddha, like a Buddha who's infinitely beneficial to all beings, total, unbounded and impartial kindness and compassion. Hard to even imagine. This is our understanding of Buddha. How did this come to be? One story is that in a distant time gone by, another kalpa, another era, the Buddha, before he was the Buddha, and we have this teaching that there's like, you know, these streams of lives that are connected. Even though there's no self going through it, there's relationship. Lives, our current life is dependent on past lives. There's an interdependent relationship. And so in an ancient life that led up to Shakyamuni Buddha becoming the Buddha, there was a Buddha. There was a Buddha long, long before Buddha. And the story that I've heard was named Shakyamuni Buddha also. There's many Buddhas with different names, but this is a Buddha like in, you know, infinite numbers of years before Shakyamuni Buddha. There was another Buddha named Shakyamuni Buddha. And there was this person there who met Shakyamuni Buddha and heard his teaching and saw this Buddha who was like just manifestation of selflessness. He just, his only reason for being alive was to just help all beings be free from suffering. And this person was so inspired by that. He's like, well, how can I just want to make a connection with this Buddha. So he was quite poor, but he had some soup that day in his home, and so just nearby, so he brought a bowl of soup and offered it to that Buddha with the intention, with the aspiration, through this offering of soup to this Buddha, may I, in the future, however long it takes, I don't care, but at some point, I really want to be like this Shakyamuni Buddha, and he's so inspiring to me, I actually want to have the name that he has. I want to be named Shakyamuni Buddha. And but not like a kind of arrogant thing, like it would be really cool to be a Buddha, but just because he's so beneficial to everyone, I want to be a Buddha and just live for all beings and practice like he does. And so we have this one story that because of that offering of a bowl of soup, and that along with this wish, may I become a Buddha, through this offering. Infinite eons later, he did that very thing. Became a Buddha named Shakyamuni Buddha. So, we might think it's a funny folk story, but isn't it an awesome thought that it could be the case? And did he remember in that life many years later that he made that vow? And even the name was in accord with that ancient vow? Maybe not. Although I guess later on, after he was the Buddha, he did remember because we have that story. But such a simple thing, right? Offering a bowl of soup, which, you know, like the Global Sangha makes this bowls of soup every week here and offers them to the homeless garden. I don't know if they make this aspiration. May this soup pot at the homeless garden, may this activity be the cause of us being able to be even more infinitely beneficial to all beings as time goes on. That could be like added even to the soup offering. That kind of wish is like the bodhicitta. Even without the wish, of course, it's incalculable merit offering the bowl of soup. The wish just kind of like channels it. And there's another story of the Buddha and maybe some life after that. Because then once he started that, he was on this trajectory toward just that little intention was offering the bowl of soup was the original cause, we might say, of becoming Shakyamuni Buddha. And like we're here now in the Santa Cruz Zen Center because of Shakyamuni Buddha. So we could say we're really sitting here tonight because he offered that bowl of soup eons and eons ago. So it's just to say that we need not take any action lightly. Every little thing we do is like having these effects. So there was another story of in a later life, we have these six realms of beings, right? That's where we are born and die, according to Buddha Dharma. The traditional teachings is that we're not necessarily born as humans. There's other realms, depending on our actions. We kind of move up and down the suffering scale, life to life. And there's these so-called lower realms, like hell. There's hell, heaven and hell realms in Buddhism. You might not have known that. Of course, they're impermanent. but they last for a while sometimes. And the Buddha, well, the Bodhisattva, he was a Bodhisattva on this path to Buddhahood. One life, he found himself in a hell realm. So, apparently, the one who would become Shakyamuni Buddha did some nasty things at some point, some harmful things, because that's how one ends up in these kind of painful realms. So it was a long process. He was way down there. And like many of these types of stories, there's a lot of fire down there. And there's the guards in the hell realm have fiery pitchforks, prods. This is Buddha sutras, right? And you can take this metaphorically or literally as you wish, or don't take it at all. But this is a story that we have in our tradition of beings. Maybe let me just add in parentheses here in case you're wondering how to take this kind of thing, that we also have this teaching. Everything is created by mind. So these are mind beings. You might have had dreams like this. And you might have dreams like this in the future. Of beings with like glowing hot prods. And the task in this realm of Buddha, with a Bodhisattva and a friend of his, another hell being, were asked to like pull this very heavy cart. It was like on fire. Some say it's like was like a fire wheel, and they had to, you know, very hot, and it didn't. work very well. It was like a cart with square wheels or something, very heavy. And they could barely pull it like an inch every hour. And so they'd be constantly prodded with these hot prods because they weren't pulling it fast enough. That's how it is in hell. You might have noticed sometimes. It can feel like that, yeah. So this was maybe 10 or 20,000 years they were doing this, trying to pull this cart. And at one point, after a long, long time of pulling this together, Buddha felt like some camaraderie with this other hell being there. They were sweating together, being prodded together. And the Buddha was like, this Bodhisattva, right, before he was the Buddha, at some point was like, this is ridiculous. We're both just getting prodded. We're not getting anywhere. There's no point in, we're both just suffering, like, immensely anyway. And there's no way out of this. But let me see if I can make a deal with the guard here, the prodder. So he said, excuse me, would you mind if you could leave the harness on me, but take the harness off my friend here, and I'll work on pulling the cart. And, I can probably pull it just about as fast, an inch every year or whatever. And just give him a little break. And the guard said something like, what do you think, you can get beings out of their karma? You can't mess with cause and effect like that. I'm gonna give you an extra prod for even thinking that. So that's what happened, but actually, as soon as the prod was about to poke the Buddha, that Bodhisattva again, he instantly disappeared in that realm, died in that realm. Sometimes you don't really die, aren't really born and die in the usual way in these realms, I've heard. So because they're like dream worlds, right? They're mind worlds. He disappeared due to that intention of kindness and was reborn in another dream world called the human world, which is is still a lot of suffering, right? But it was a little bit easier for him. And his evolution continued like this. So I find that a very moving story, that even when extremely tortured, just the thought of you don't need to torture my friend, just keep torturing me. Just that thought to help relieve somebody else of a little bit of suffering was actually continued the Buddha along his path, the Bodhisattva. So sometimes we say Buddha nature is it's like the Buddha that's already free from suffering and already compassionate, but it's like blocked by all these karmic hindrances and delusions built up over all these eons of confusion. So it's like a seed, in a way, like a seed of Buddha. We already have, this is this teaching of the Mahayana, our Buddha potential is already fully complete. And it's not a matter of improving it in the slightest, it's just a matter of revealing it. So if Buddha nature is like a seed, kindness, loving kindness, Maitri, or in Pali, Metta, is the ground, the soil we can plant that seed in. It's like the seed's already here, fully, perfectly fine seed, ready to sprout, but it needs some ground, it needs some soil to grow in. It's just being stored in this jar. We call this storehouse consciousness, maybe, for so long, right? It's just waiting to sprout into a Buddha. So we need to plant it to help it grow. Loving kindness, which is just the wish that everybody be happy. May all beings be happy. That attitude, that spirit is the soil we can plant our Buddha nature seed in. But then it can get kind of dry, so it needs some water. And compassion is the water. Compassion is like the wish that all beings be free from suffering. Very similar to may all beings be happy. But it's maybe a little further step. It's maybe a little bit deeper in a way. I don't know, we can discuss this over the year. Maybe equally deep. But working together, the water of compassion, falling down on the ground of kindness, and helping the seed of Buddha nature to sprout into a Bodhi tree. And the Bodhi tree is like bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the mind of awakening. Relative bodhicitta is just that aspiration to remove all the obstructions that block this, our true heart of Buddha nature. So the relative bodhicitta, thought of awakening, is the aspiration. I really want to be a Buddha. Let the Buddha nature shine completely for the benefit of all beings. And the ultimate bodhicitta is the mind of awakening. It's the awakened mind. And as we'll see, Dogen kind of plays with, well, what, is there some difference between this aspiration, true wholehearted aspiration to, I want to be completely free of all my karmic stuff so that I can really meet people with total openness. Is there a difference between that aspiration and the actual awakened mind itself? Maybe, maybe not. This is what we can explore. So aspiration, as we begin a new year, as we begin a practice period, something for everybody to consider. I want to consider. What is our aspiration? Practice aspiration, or maybe, well, I don't need a practice aspiration. I just have the aspiration to, go swimming next summer, whatever. So any aspiration we might have, but particularly in a practice period, we could say, what am I doing here anyway? What is the point of all this practice? And it might be some version of bodhicitta, or it might not. Bodhicitta can sound really exalted, like I want to become a fully awakened Buddha and benefit all beings infinitely, like these four vows that we chant at the end of the talks. If you take them seriously, it's almost too much. They're almost ridiculously vast. So that can be our aspiration, to really like say yes completely to those vows. Or it might be like, actually, that's too big. I want to work on some practical things. Like, or maybe both. I feel like I kind of like, I want to see if this bodhicitta thing, partly the reason I think this is a nice theme is because like, I want to see if I'm really up for this. I have a question, whether I really like am up for this bodhicitta thing myself. I confess. What? Kokyo's not up for it, what, you know? Then maybe I shouldn't bother. So I don't know if I am or not. I want to check it out. I mean, it's easy to say, right? Of course I'm up for it, but like really? I mean, whatever, like part of the thing is like I think whatever it takes, I want to become, save all beings and all delusions. enter all Dharma gates and become Buddha. I'd say, but only if I, you know, can still like hold on to these various things. So that's, I think that's why I have doubts, because I'm like, I kind of don't know if I can, let go of everything. And also, kindness and compassion that are necessary conditions and fuel for this bodhicitta. I want to really explore that. I have an aspiration this year to really look at the hindrances to kindness and compassion and how they work. I heard one teaching that something like that the fruits of kindness, just loving kindness practice, the fruits are that, how is it said exactly? That we're not so prone to irritation and annoyance at the deluded actions of sentient beings. I thought that's pretty nice, including my own deluded actions. In a way, we're all sentient beings, and in a certain sense, all our actions are deluded, basically. So it's not such an insult, really. It's like universally true. And sometimes these deluded actions that we all do are like annoying and irritating. But I thought that was nice, is that one of the apart from Buddhahood as the ultimate fruit, just the immediate result of practicing loving kindness is we're not quite so prone to irritation and annoyance at the deluded actions of sentient beings. I thought, yeah, that sounds good. So, does anybody else have an aspiration that has recently or arisen a while ago that you'd like to express? Yes.
Maybe I do. I'm not sure, but I wanted to first just speak to something that you said.
Sure.
You know, when you kind of confess, gee, you know, I'm not sure I'm up to it, because it seems so difficult to think of the vows.
Yeah.
I and then you talk about hindrance. I think it's so important to remember that it's only by looking at your hindrance and by having them, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where it is then not just this lofty kind of thing, oh yeah, right, I want to save all beings. But it's where you trip up, or where I trip up, that's where the real person that we are meets the real life.
Yeah.
And that's the very place to practice.
Mm-hmm. So that's the very place.
I hope we can all just be really honest in looking at, you know. But to me, where the aspiration comes in is then rather than giving up, or rather than thinking, well, it means I'm a failure or you're a failure, the aspiration is kind of the picking yourself back up.
Yep.
Continuing to be as kind and loving as you can, even if the moment before you were just not that.
Yep. One of the, you know, there's many, many kind of conditions or causes and supports for bodhicitta that we can explore through the whole year. And one of them is not giving up, actually. You know, when it's kind of like, this is too much, like, I've given it a try, and like, it's too much, forget it. And so, like, and which is very easy to do with something so immense, and not giving up is like, I just, fall down 99 times and get up 100. Yes.
It's my life. It's my name. To be patient with my impatience.
Patience is a great one.
But the more I go into it, the slower it is. But it's still there. It's still, because it's being able to see that. And I wanted to ask you, besides annoyance, what are your other favorite five hindrances, or four, or three, or two, that you are intending now because of your trip? Now you're back in Surville, sunny Santa Cruz, to work with.
Hindrances to work with. I think, you know, I think if looking at those positive qualities of kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta, I'd say that what are the obstacles to them? if there's not a feeling of kindness, it's like, yeah, there's various factors that I think are the hindrances. Like, I think not paying attention is one of them, you know? Like, just usually when we get, like, worked up about something, we're just not present, actually. We're, like, we're caught by something, right? So, actually, like, stepping back to look. So this is the kind of wisdom part, too, and looking at what's actually happening here with some, you know, a larger perspective. So wisdom is involved, examination, and just openness, and yeah, seeing where every situation is different. Like the things that in others that might annoy me, that block the compassion, it's something in me that is, you know, not holding back from giving something. Like maybe somebody's taking too much time, for example, right? Yeah. So then it's like, and I'm feeling resistance and annoyance and the lack of kindness and compassion. So there is kind of like that stepping back of like, what is it about me and my time? For me, actually, time is that's one of my attachments. Like personal time, like I enjoy being alone a lot, which for Bodhisattva is kind of maybe a little dangerous, maybe a little good too, because you can do it. Buddha, I think, spent a lot of time alone, cultivating his mind. So there's time and a place for it, yeah. So like things like that are, if it's like, this is my time now. So I confess that's one that I can work on. I think I'll see in the moment, you know, I think different things arise. What are the specific blockages? Attachment, basically all kinds of attachments are basically what block kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta. I think that's it, and there's infinite kinds. I do have, like, you know, lists. As I think I mentioned before, my teacher likes to call karmic inventory. It's nice to have a karmic inventory and like take a little, like, you know, here's your like list of like 20 different attachments that are kind of specific to me that I kind of work on. Yeah, I bring it one of the other days.
Did Greg give those to you, or did you find them yourself, or both?
Well, I mean, he just suggested making your own karmic inventory. Yeah. It's different for each person.
Yeah.
So I've done that over different years, and it's nice then to compare the years and see, wow, 20 years ago, there's my karmic inventory. 20 years later, half of them are identical. Amazing. Yeah, in a way, right? In a way, like, it does change. Yeah, some of them are actually gone. Some of them are, like, non-issues. Yeah, and some are like maybe those ones that stay for 20 years. Are like those are like the big ones,
lifelong.
Yeah, so it's nice to make those lists. You know.
I think the key is to make the list, but not to feel guilty about it.
yeah, not to feel guilty. Like I don't think I did. I don't think I felt guilt. I was more like these are the. Let me think. What are my sticking points? And then this is the list of things I want to like work on and pay attention to. They're like my blockages. And of course, since I created the list, it's probably going to look different than somebody else's version of my list. But they're like, you forgot about 20 things on your list. I'm like, oh, really? Shoho likes to remind me of things I forgot on my list. People who are close.
It's probably so good for you.
Yeah.
You can do the same for me.
Yeah, so it's good. Good. Yeah. It's helpful. Yeah, it's part of a bodhisattva. Sometimes to help other people with their karmic inventories. It's dangerous work. You have to be really close to people. You have to have a really close, trusting relationship to be able to do that, I think. Even then, it often doesn't work.
Thank you.
So, yeah. I aspire to keep looking at my list. And, you know, it's, again, often, it's just, I check in with it, you know. It's a stack of papers, and oh, there's that list. Sometimes I don't find it for a couple of years, even. Right? Oh, let's check it out. So they're nice. Just not so much like you got to work, you got to do this. Yeah, I don't feel so guilty. It's more like it's more like just, I kind of know myself more and see how my tendencies over time. Any other aspirations? This is maybe something we can also focus on, you know, meeting, one-on-one meetings are a great time to express aspirations, especially at the beginning of the year. Something my teacher would sometimes ask everybody to, you know, let him know their deepest intention. Because then you have to think about it a little bit, and if you express it to somebody else too, that's it's a little different then. It kind of, you feel it's a little more like real. I think that's why we have ceremonies to do that. To express, allow to a group. It's and we'll study that through this year too. Yes.
So I guess my aspiration, just beginning today actually, what is that I want to nurture any openness and trust that I feel in this process that I'm going through.
So wonderful.
A little bit of openness and trust that I feel, I'm going to go with that.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes will come. What, you know, whatever happens, happens.
That sounds like a great spirit. Mm-hmm. Trust in the process, openness to the process, and the acceptance of whatever comes.
And it'll have to be a nurturance of whatever little bit that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It might be just a little bit.
That's how it is. That's one of the teachings too, is that that bodhicitta, this kind, even that kind of any aspiration, but bodhicitta is an aspiration that is very fragile, and so it's like a little spark, and you can feel it for a second. And then it easily disappears. So it has to be nurtured, tended very carefully, like a small baby, or like your own eyes, or like this. So yeah, that sounds like wonderful, and that's an intention, right? An aspiration or an intention, and by having that, then next time you're like right at the gateway of like open or not open, then some either consciously, oh yeah, I actually said that. I intend to be open, so I really don't want to, but I'll try it this time. Or maybe even not consciously, you know, just by saying that intention, it plants a seed in your larger being, in your mind stream, that like sometimes you even spontaneously just go in the direction of openness, and you don't even know why, but maybe because you just, you know, consciously gave rise to the intention now. All these things can work like that. Yes, Yaro.
I have to say I've been very conscious lately of my, not so much speech, negative speech, but just negative thought. Like, I noticed going downtown today to the market and just kind of seeing the array of kind of Santa Cruz freakiness, you know, just the different characters in Santa Cruz, and just kind of an automatic kind of, you know, critical sort of feeling about, you know, those people, just kind of my mind automatically saying, oh, they're weird, or, you know, whatever. And so just feeling like that's a place to practice. It's just observing whoever and whatever with a more open and less kind of automatically kind of critical.
Yeah. People that you don't know so well are actually sometimes really great way to practice, because you can say, well, what is it? Those people aren't really bothered. They're not like doing the weird thing like in my house, so it's not that bad. I'm just passing through town. So then you can kind of see that and feel a little bit, you know, more open to the strangers like that, right? And then it sometimes gets harder when it's people that are closer. So it's great practice, I think, with people in town, as you walk through town.
Well, I just noticed in India, I guess because it was such a different context and everything was so different, that in a way I could accept the difference more.
I didn't automatically kind of label it in a certain way.
It was more extremely different than it's easier in a way?
Extremely different, so it's kind of like I just felt, you know, somehow I didn't kind of automatically go there. But back here I find I have more kind of judgments, kind of these internal judgments kind of going on. So just kind of being mindful of that.
Yeah.
Just, you know, when I'm noticing it, just, you know, bringing blessings about or something different.
Yeah.
Just kind of this critical moment.
Sounds great. Let's collect the teacups. Anyone else? Thoughts? Yes.
I want to aspire to have more often a sense I had recently. I was in traffic and I noticed how, you know, the difference between thinking I'm in traffic and thinking, well, I'm part of the traffic. I am traffic.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great one. Yep.
Having less of a sense of separateness.
That's a great teaching, yes. Exactly. All these cars, what are they doing out here?
Those people.
Blocking my way, and they're all thinking the same about you. Actually, very profound, you know. That's a great example for us all to remember, because that's how everything kind of is, you know. With any kind of annoying situation, we actually are always part of it. And we might be annoying somebody else just as much. But traffic is a very obvious one. Yes.
I have an aspiration to try to just keep awake when I'm in the middle of a storm and completely caught. And I don't know what that looks like, but just studying that.
Maybe best to not know what it looks like. Awake and present. And I think our Zazen practice naturally helps with that. It's a kind of a training for that. And willing to let go.
Not pick it up.
Yeah. And having the aspiration to do that. Again, I think, and stating it as such, it's like, then the next time we're in the storm, it's like, oh yeah, this is the time, you know. Or we miss many storms, but on the, you know, 100th storm, oh yeah, this time I just remembered it. Yeah. Sometimes I think like a lot of our practice is just remembering. We actually know what to do already. It's not that complicated, but we easily forget. And then there's sometimes where we do remember and we just can't. Like, I know the thing is to let go now, but I can't let go. And but I know that's the thing to do right now. But like, I'm not going to. Sometimes it's like that. And in a way, sometimes I think at that point, it's like we're still not looking deeply enough. If we went like one level deeper, it's like, what do you mean you're not going to? Like, of course you are. So. Yes.
My aspiration is always to receive my life as it is, and especially at the moment thinking about receiving with equanimity and curiosity things that I get caught in, you know. So instead, be curious.
That's a great one. Yep. Equanimity is one thing, and curiosity is like, Moses is like, what is this actually? What's happening here anyway? Yeah. Maybe the kind of similar equanimity and curiosity. Yeah, that's wonderful.
They feed each other.
Yep. Yeah, they do. Yeah. Mm. So I'll start Sesshin tomorrow, and everyone's welcome to come for any of the zazen, or that we have morning and evening dharma talks, afternoon dharma talks, because it's a genzoe sesshin, so really get into this bodhicitta teachings. And please enjoy each other's support for these couple months, and enjoy supporting each other as just by your presence. We dedicate any merit arising from tonight's gathering to all suffering beings throughout space and time. May they discover their seed of Buddha nature, plant it in the soil of kindness, watered with compassion, grow the tree of bodhicitta. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I